This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you have watched any sports games, or honestly, really any TV at all in recent years, you've probably seen a DraftKings ad like this one, which takes place inside a potential bettor's head as Martin Lawrence moderates a debate between confidence, played by Kristen Schaal, and indecision, played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
All right, team, time to bet NFL games. Confidence.
I'm feeling a parlay with more legs than a spider.
So nine legs?
Roll the dice, baby.
Indecision?
We pick one home favorite. I abstain.
You can't abstain.
Boring. Six-leg parlay, two home dogs, all hitting the over. Boom!
Boom. The Boston-based online fantasy sports and sports betting company, which employs hundreds of workers in Boston alone, has been spending a lot of money on advertising in recent years. And now some analysts are wondering if maybe the company is making some bad bets. Joining us for a closer look, Boston Globe business reporter Aaron Pressman. His story in today's edition, print edition, is headlined, DraftKings draws a losing hand in 2021, faces challenges in online gambling. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Aaron, is it fair to say that essentially DraftKings basically brought legalized online sports betting to Massachusetts, sort of the venue or vehicle of choice here in the Commonwealth?
Well, you can't bet online in Massachusetts yet. But they were one of the earliest players. That FanDuel and DraftKings were the earliest players. Certainly you can do the daily fantasy betting here, which
right.
is regularly differently. But we're still waiting for that cranky Massachusetts legislature to legalize online betting.
No, and I do appreciate the clarification. As a sort of not my world, this part, I lose track of the actual sports betting versus the fantasy. And I think it's an important clarification for our listeners, too. So give us a sense of just how big DraftKings is to the economy in the area. I mean, their headquarters is right here. How big of a player are they?
They're one of the biggest technology companies in the Boston area. They have a beautiful headquarters in the Back Bay, which I visited. Unfortunately, you know, most people are still working at home, but it's a really neat office space. They have hundreds of employees. And until recently, you know, we're one of the most highly valued tech startups in the Boston area, although their stock has really been taking it on the nose this year.
So that's the story, right? They looked, let's, you know, stick with the metaphor. They looked like such a good bet at the beginning of the year. And you write about a really interesting decline, let's say, over the last 9 months or so. Talk about that.
Well, part of it is a larger picture that I think there was a lot of excitement about online betting as the next huge tech market, just like there was about, you know, electric cars or e-commerce one time. And right now we're in a period where people are more skeptical and wondering, you know, how well it will really play out. If you look at DraftKings results, they spend an awful lot of money for each dollar of revenue they bring in, and they're currently racking up big losses. Now, that's what happens in early markets, right? That's what happened with Amazon, say, but it doesn't always work out. So right now we're at a stage where some things have gone against them this year, and people are now more worried that it won't work out.
Okay, to be clear, your article says they've spent more than $700 million in the first 9 months of 2021 on marketing.
That's right. Relative to their revenue of $822 million, and the revenue cost them $540 million, you know, to get it. So if you add $540 million to get the revenue and $703 million of sales and marketing, you know, you're deep in the red.
Why else are people getting nervous about the company? I understand there's an SEC investigation. Maybe give us a quick look at that.
Sure. They needed some better technology to offer the kinds of sophisticated, complicated bets that sports bettors like when you can bet on like three different teams and whether there's a touchdown in the first quarter. So they merged with, they bought a Bulgarian software company. And earlier this year, some research from Wall Street came out saying, now this is from people who are betting against the stock, but saying that this company they acquired, SB Tech, maybe was supplying software illegally in parts of Asia where online betting was illegal, and was DraftKings profiting from this illegal use of the software. DraftKings denies any wrongdoing, but the SEC is investigating to find out, you know, what's really going on there.
So in the sports world, we have homers and haters, right? Those who root for the home team and those who hate the opposing team. People in this Commonwealth, as you point out, actual sports betting, not legal here yet. Gambling, very controversial here in the Commonwealth. How does that reflect on DraftKings, and how does DraftKings' story right now reflect on that future here?
Right. I think a year ago, you know, it seemed like a lot of states were very quickly legalizing online gambling and online sports betting. And that's really, you know, what DraftKings' future is about. But now there's concern, right? If you look at the comments on my story on our website, there's a lot of concern of people worried about the effects of online gambling and gambling addiction. So to the extent that people worry about online gambling, that they regulate it more, that they tax it more highly, that they slow down the process of legalizing it, DraftKings market won't materialize as quickly as maybe it seemed like it would last year.
Although you can bet on sports on DraftKings in New Hampshire, correct?
I think that's right. My favorite story is that when betting was legal in New Jersey, but not New York, people would walk across the George Washington Bridge to see at a certain point you could big gamble on the George Washington Bridge.
All right. So just briefly, Aaron, what are you watching for next?
Well, I think the next big thing is what can they do beyond just sports gambling? You know, they have started to get into crypto and become a market for non-fungible tokens, which are those sort of collectibles that are digital. That's a big thing. Also, esports gambling has not really even been a thing yet. That's, you know, these huge video game tournaments that people watch. Could there be gambling on that they could take and get into? And what other kinds of new markets, maybe beyond just this sports betting, could they get into? That's what we're looking for next year.
Okay, that's Boston Globe business reporter Aaron Pressman talking to us about DraftKings. Aaron, thank you.
Thanks.
So what we're going to be looking for is the Patriots-Bills game tonight. It won't be in Gillette Stadium, but it will be in Buffalo, and it is a big matchup at 8:15 tonight. Here to help us check the score and convince you to watch it, Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
So you got 5 minutes to make the case, Chris, and tonight is a very big game, even for people who maybe don't usually watch. Tell us.
It's a huge game. I would say, you know, the Tom Brady coming back to Gillette was the biggest game story-wise of the year, but in terms of football and performance and playoffs and all that, this is the game of the year. And I got to tell you, I love the fact that if you look at the forecast right now, they're saying possible snow and whipping winds in Buffalo, which is absolutely what you want to hear for your Monday night winter football game. So I say it's a perfect night to, you know, if you got a fireplace, light the fire, grab your favorite beverage and tune on into this team, which is on a 6-game winning streak, the Patriots. They are really making a push and have taken over that first spot in their division, the AFC East.
And that was not supposed to happen, Chris.
No, it wasn't. This was actually kind of pegged on the schedule as the game where you pass the torch to Buffalo, right? Buffalo snapped the Patriots' streak of 11 division titles in a row last year by winning the AFC East, and they beat the Patriots twice last year. You kind of had this game circled as the game like, okay, Buffalo now asserts their dominance long term, and yet here Bill Belichick and the Patriots are in first place once again.
Because ...
Well, a lot of reasons. I will say one is you can't count out Bill Belichick. He's the greatest coach to ever coach the game. I also think it's actually not super surprising just in terms of the way the NFL has gone. Mac Jones is the rookie quarterback playing for the Patriots this year. He's doing pretty well. And the league is actually kind of structured to reward teams that have decent quarterbacks on their rookie deal, right? You get drafted by a team. Sign a contract for 4 or 5 years at a certain amount of money. And so before you've proven yourself, you're pretty affordable
there
as a player, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at the last 20 quarterbacks to play in the Super Bowl, 9 of those have been on their rookie deal. And of the 11 that were not, 6 of those were Tom Brady. So basically a winning formula is to have a guy who can hold it down, just manage the game, not make too many mistakes, and let the players around him, you have more money to spend on other positions, which we saw the Patriots do in the offseason. We talked about all that free agent money they spent.
Yes, we did.
A lot of that money really paying off. They put together a really nice run here.
So unless it's Tom Brady, you want a rookie quarterback. We've got one. Last year, kind of tough. This year, looking different. Sort of juxtapose for us. The agony of defeat last year and the potential joy of victory this year.
I mean, kind of tough does not describe what last
true.
Year. Last year was painful all the way through. And it wasn't even just that they weren't good. You expected a little bit of a hiccup there. But it was the way they lost games. Their offense looked terrible. They couldn't move the ball. But it was the stupid mistakes that really killed me. Throughout Bill Belichick's time at the helm of the Patriots, it's always been the other team making the stupid mistakes. Last year, it was the Patriots. I actually go back to the Week 8 game they played against the Buffalo Bills.
Oh, no.
They were 2-4. It was like this was your chance to kind of try to stay relevant in the division. They're driving late in the fourth quarter. They're down 3, but they're already in field goal range. Look like they're at least going to tie, maybe win. And then this happened.
Newton will keep it. Newton.
Oh, he lost the ball. Buffalo takes over. Cam Newton coughs it up with 31 seconds left.
I hate you for playing that again. That was painful enough.
I hate myself for playing that. I mean, just brutal, brutal all the way through last year. So to see them competitive this year is a real pleasant surprise.
All right, lightly. 90 seconds. So play us some happy sound and tell us what's going to happen.
Well, I got to say, in addition to Mac Jones playing well, the weapons around him have been phenomenal, particularly loving Kendrick Bourne, the wide receiver. He's come up huge lately, including last week against the Titans.
We are in the flurry stage of this pass. Hauled in. Bourne redirects to the outside. Still going. Kendrick Bourne breaks away. Touchdown, Patriots.
That's a little better taste more like it. Right?
That's right. Okay, Chris, you got just a couple seconds left. Give me your, I know you love to prognosticate. What's going to happen?
I like the Pats tonight. Look, I'll stay within the segment here. DraftKings has the Bills listed as 2.5 points favorite.
There you go.
I think the bad weather plays to the Patriots' advantage. The Bills like to throw a lot. That's tough to do when the whipping winds. I say low scoring game, Pats on top, 21-17.
Now that's the way to do it like a homer, and I mean that in the best way possible. Checking the score with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks so much.
Don't.
In a moment, you're going to hear about a little girl and her teacher and the incredible impact of, believe it or not, having a pair of pants that actually fit. Stories like these inspire the work of Cradles to Crayons. It's a national clothing nonprofit founded and operating here in Boston. Over the weekend, dozens of their volunteers packed and distributed more than 100,000 pieces of clothing. It's part of an annual push by the organization to get items to those who need them. Last week before the drive, we spoke with Lynn Margario, founder and CEO of Cradles to Crayons, and she told us about the increased need and what her organization is doing to ease the burden, one that can be heightened at the holidays.
Across the country, we estimate that more than 20 million kids do not have access to clean, well-fitting, and seasonally appropriate clothing. And this is probably only the tip of the iceberg, because when you look in a, you know, at the high cost of a city like where we are, Boston, the cost to pay rent, put food on the table, pay for childcare, and the myriad other things just often does not leave enough funds to pay for clothes and that winter coat that they need to be healthy, safe, and warm outside.
So you're talking about families that are literally having to make decisions between, does my child eat or does my child have a coat that is warm enough for the winter?
Families are making those choices every single day.
Is there a family you've met that really sticks in your mind right now?
So there's a child that I'm thinking of, and this is a kindergartner who was in the class, and she was a fidgeter. She was known as a fidgeter. Her teacher wondered if she had special needs because she was disruptive in the classroom and they were having her evaluated. And one day this little girl had to go to the bathroom. The teacher took her to the bathroom and the little girl asked her, "Can you help me zip my pants?" And the teacher tried to zip her pants and said, I can't. And the little girl just sucked in her stomach and said, "I do this every day for mommy." And the teacher realized this was a girl who was going to school with pants that were at least two sizes too small. And she was just so uncomfortable. That was causing her to squirm. And she was being, you know, picked on in the classroom as well. And so something as simple as a pair of pants that didn't fit was leading to all these other consequences. And when she received a package from Cradles to Crayons, she was able to kind of hold her head up high and go into that classroom and participate. Sometimes it's that simple.
Lynn, how much worse? I guess I'm assuming it's gotten much worse since the start of the pandemic, especially going into the second pandemic holiday season now. Am I right? Is it worse? And if so, how much more?
So we have some measures, and we include diapers when we think about clothing insecurity, because that's the underwear for our youngest members of a community. Prior to the pandemic, we were providing, just here in Massachusetts, we were providing a few hundred thousand diapers a year, and that increased to over 4 million during the pandemic. Across our network, we've provided more than 12 million diapers, an increase of over 300%. So we are seeing that. And, another interesting measure that I see is when you look at the right now temporary child tax credit and what families are using that additional monthly funds for, it's paying for basic needs. They're using it to pay for rent. They're using it to pay for utilities. They're putting food on the table. And we're seeing in surveys that they're using it to pay for clothing and children's school supplies. And so we see that there is just a very large need across the country for additional support to just meet basic needs.
So you've said 20 million children across the United States without clean, well-fitting, seasonally appropriate clothes. That's equivalent to the state of New York. These are not small numbers. You've said we may be missing kids. It sounds like you have a strong belief, policy position on the child tax credit. $250, $300 per child is being distributed through the American Rescue Plan. How much difference do those benefits make? And do you have a position on whether an extension on those or permanence for those is the priority? I'm interested in your take.
So, Tiziana, absolutely. And I think we have a once in a generation or maybe even once in a lifetime opportunity right now with the Build Back Better to make a real and lasting difference to address child poverty. So, absolutely, I'm a big advocate for making that child tax credit in particular permanent, but also looking at other policies at the state level and elsewhere for addressing gaps like clothing insecurity or addressing diaper need, which are not covered by any government programs today.
Lynn, I'm sure you have heard the critics who would say government cannot be the solution to kids' everyday basic needs. What do you say to critics who say we cannot solve this through government direct transfer payments? There have to be ways to support independent economic viability for families.
And I would say it's not an either or. It is a yes and. We need to have everybody stepping up to recognize that we have pretty extreme and growing income inequality. And, most of the families that we provide supports to, they have at least one person working in the household, and they're just not making enough to cover their basic needs. So we all need to step up. There are things we as individuals can do, particularly entering this holiday season. Where can we provide supports? Where can we donate funds or products or our time to make a difference? As employers, where can we be increasing wages and providing living wages to people so that, yes, they can achieve some self-sufficiency? And in the meantime, we need these government programs there with direct transfer payments and other programmatic supports to ensure that the families who are falling through the cracks and the families who are experiencing and individuals who are experiencing hard times are able to weather those.
Last question for you, Lynn. You founded Cradles to Crayons almost 20 years ago. Did you imagine then the scope of the need that you're seeing now?
I did not. I did not. When I started Cradles to Crayons, I was looking at it really from the supply side of the equation, realizing that kids grow so fast that there are things that they have, that we all have in our homes that are still in beautiful, like new condition that could make a difference in the life of another child or family. I didn't then really appreciate the size of and the scope of the need. And when you look at statistics, you know, using federal poverty level as a measure, it just so vastly understates the cost of being self-sufficient in this country in 2021, that, you know, the need is much, much larger than what official poverty statistics would lead you to believe.
Lynn Margarier there, founder and CEO of Cradles to Crayons, and we'll have more information how to get involved at our website, radioboston.org. But this time of year, I often think a lot about movies, the big blockbusters you're going to watch during winter break, those Oscar contenders that come out just in time to make sure everybody's thinking about them when the acting nominations happen. But then, of course, last year and this year, just questions about the industry as well and how COVID and this pandemic will affect movie watchers, moviegoers, and the movies we watch in the long term. So let's have a conversation about it. With us today, Ty Burr, writer and film critic at Ty Burr Watchlist and a friend of Radio Boston. Happy holidays, Ty.
Hey, how you doing, Tiziana?
Doing great, thanks. And we're going to dive into some movies and some great movie sound in a minute. I know you brought a few for us to talk to, but I do want to ask you, Ty, are we even talking about the same thing anymore? Are we apples to apples when we think about holiday season movies this year versus years in the past?
Well, it's everything's up in the air now because the industry is still recovering from 2 years of pandemic, closed theaters, delayed films. West Side Story is opening this week. It was supposed to come out last year. And there's still a big question about whether you'll be able to get sizable audiences in movie theaters. And also on top of that, many studios are sending their new films to streaming at the same time or shortly thereafter that they're playing in theaters. So the marbles are rolling in all sorts of different places.
And do we know how it's going to shake out? Is this the end for the most part of movie theaters, or are we speaking too soon because we just don't know?
I think you're speaking too soon. I think there will always be an audience to go see especially big special effects-driven films in a movie theater, whether that's the movie theater is operating under, you know, pandemic restrictions, partial seating, and other things. I still think, especially the big franchise films that the studios really make these days, superhero films, those will always be in theaters.
So I want to go to one of these films that has had sort of a resurgence, not the film itself, but you mentioned it, West Side Story, and musicals have had a bit of a resurgence, and you can see the appeal of seeing those on the big screen. I admit when I first heard it was going to come out, I thought, oh, this could be really cringeworthy, this reboot by Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner. But it seems like it's had some great runtime. Getting great reviews. I want to play just a little bit of sound right here.
You know, I wake up to everything I know either getting sold or wrecked or being taken over by people that I don't like.
You keep away from him as long as you're in my house.
I'm a grown-up now, Bernardo. I'm gonna think for myself.
Tony, we need you if we're going to war.
You can kind of see the sweeping characters coming across the screen, Ty. Is it worth it? Have they done a good job?
They did a really good job. And like you and like many people, when we heard there was going to be a remake of this classic film, it's like, why bother? And yet Steven Spielberg has pulled it off with a fantastic cast and, importantly, a really strong script and new book by Tony Kushner, the award-winning playwright. The cast is fantastic. Ansel Elgort as Tony, newcomer Rachel Zegler as Maria. They sing their own songs, which was not true, of Natalie Wood, as much as we love her in the original.
She did not sing.
She did not sing. The Hispanic characters are played by Hispanics. They speak Spanish and English in the movie. It feels like an enhanced version of the first movie. The camera movement is as elegant as the choreography already was. You really feel... I wish I could tell people to go see it in a movie theater. It's up to the individual. But it really does transport you to the place that, you know, the best musicals take you to, this other world where people sing and dance. And yeah, it's Romeo and Juliet. So the ending is what the ending is, but you really feel taken someplace special. I was really delighted that this worked out.
So I want to pick up on something that couldn't be more sort of polar opposite, the power of the dog. The mm-hmm. reviews have been incredible. Takes place yes. on a ranch in the 1920s in Montana. Phil, who is played by Benedict Cumberbatch, is a bully who picks on his nephew Peter, who's played by Cody Smith McPhee. I have to tell you, I hear he's so good. I'm not sure I want to sit through 2 hours of watching somebody be that good at being that awful, Ty.
Well, you know, he's mesmerizingly awful. And the more the movie goes on, the more layers you discover to this character and why he is the way he is. It really is this fascinating takedown of a very specific kind of American machismo mentality. Cumberbatch is remarkable in it, especially when you consider that the other movie he made this year, which is on Amazon, called The Electrical Life of Lewis Wayne. He plays a polar opposite character. He's really, I think the Academy is probably going to sit up and notice what an incredible job he's done this year. But this is Jane Campion bringing another one of her stories, like The Piano, that's really emotionally intense, but filmed with just, she's a master of filmmaking.
All right, I'm actually going to move on and play us a little sound now from another movie this year. The film is King Richard, and we're going to play part of a scene where Richard William, the father of Venus and Serena, who's being played by Will Smith, is coaching a young Venus and explaining to her the burden that she carries, the obstacles she faces as a young, black, aspiring professional athlete in the world. Here's a little sound.
One day my father took me to town. He gave me this money to pay this white man for something. Back in them days, black folks weren't allowed to touch white peoples. So I went to get a man this money, and I accidentally touched his hand. And he stopped beating on me. He knocked me down, his friends come over, they all start stomping on me and beating on me. And I look up and I see my father in the crowd. He took off running.
And he goes on to explain to his daughter, I don't. I protect you. But also, this is the kind of world you're coming into. You know, it's a really interesting look at their father, who was a controversial figure in tennis.
Still is.
Yeah. So talk about that. Talk about this film, what appeals to you about it, why we want to see this one.
Well, you remember what I was saying about Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, the Academy taking a look at him. If he has any competition, it is Will Smith, in a remarkable comeback, for somebody who's sort of been out of the pop culture loop for a while. This is a movie that was executive produced by Venus and Serena Williams. So it does not paint their father as a saint. And we should be thankful that it is I don't think it's all the warts, but it's some of the warts, and all portrayal. It focuses on the father, but it also focuses on the young daughters as they are struggling to be themselves, be teenage girls, but also be the best tennis players they can be. And a lot of the enjoyment of the movie is watching this family from Compton intersect with the very white, very upper-class tennis world and say, look, we can do this, and we are going to do this. And the funny thing about the movie is that every time Richard Williams says something in the movie where he just makes this incredible boast, like, you know, Venus is going to win Wimbledon 5 times, we know that everything he says is true, and that adds to just the enjoyment of it.
So in talking about these three films, Ty, here's what's striking to me, because I know you have said, you know, I think you said the marbles are kind of rolling all over the place. Films got held, you know, didn't release when they were normally supposed to. We don't necessarily know that there's a theme this year. And yet all three of these films have to do with issues we are thinking about and talking about right now. Race, class, culture, brutal masculinity. There are undertones of homophobia in the Benedict Cumberbatch film. These do still seem to be films that are holding a mirror back up to us. Is that still what films this time of year do? They tend to summarize the year we've had.
Yeah, but I agree. And the movies at the end of the year tend to be serious movies, or have serious themes, at least. Nevertheless, look at how all of these movies, with the exception of one that I think we're going to be talking about, bury those themes in entertainments. King Richard is a very entertaining film. West Side Story is heart-wrenching, but it's absolutely a classic old-school musical. Power of the Dog is very, very intense, but it takes you away to this old Wild West setting. You are taken away from the issues. We're given the issues, but in almost like metaphorical sense. I think we're going to talk about one in a little bit, Don't Look Up, which is the opposite of that.
All right. So actually, we have a little bit of time here, but we have a short bit from Don't Look Up that's move 3 in the control room. Let's just play that real quick.
What Dr. Mindy is trying to say is that there's a comet headed directly towards Earth.
And then what happens if a tidal wave? It will be far more catastrophic. There will be mile-high tsunamis.
So how certain is this?
There's 100%. Certainty of impact.
Please don't say 100%.
Can we just call it a potentially significant event?
But it isn't potentially going to happen.
99.78% to be exact.
Oh, great.
So we have just enough time, Ty, about 45 seconds for you to tell us why this one's on your
list.
This
is an all-star movie about the end of the world from Adam McKay, who did The Big Short. It's extremely topical. It was made during COVID. It addresses directly the divisions that are pulling us apart. And it's entertaining, but it's also a little unnerving. And my sense is that people aren't going to want to see something that's this close to home.
Even though it sounds like it's sort of funny and tongue-in-cheek.
It is funny and tongue-in-cheek, but it also does not. It takes off the gloves. It's going to be available on Netflix, as is Power of the Dog. So people may stay home and watch it. But I still think that our nerves are so raw these days that I don't know whether we're going to be wanting to see something that kind of bangs on them so directly.
All right. That is Ty Burr, writer and film critic at Ty Burr Watchlist. Friend of the show, Ty, thanks.
It's Ty Burr's Watchlist at .substack.com.
There you go. Ty Burr's Watchlist at .substack.com.
.substack.com.
We can put a link on our website at radioboston.org. And we're going out on tonight from Steven Spielberg's new take on West Side Story. That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Tune in tomorrow for more.